Welcome to the latest installment of the Grant Street Experience. I'm your host, Grant Irvin. Excited to be with everyone today. The Grant Street Experience is our podcast about all the fun and interesting things that are happening along Grant Street. And today we have a real special guest with us, Melanie Areola, who is our Student Conservation Association Fellow and co-host, as always, Rebecca Kiernan by our side. Rebecca, how are you today?
I'm all right. How are you?
Looking good. Looking good. Melanie, you too. Wonderful background there.
Yes, I wish it was real, but it's makes a good virtual background.
I'm waiting for like an Ewok or so, like a star, you know, from Star Wars and Return of the Jedi to come out behind you or something. So so just to get started, so we've had a long and really great history with the Student Conservation Association and the work that they have done on our team with the state with the sustainability team here in the city of Pittsburgh. Melanie, maybe just to begin our conversation today, if you could tell us a little bit about SCA and then your history and background into how you became an SCA fellow.
Yeah, so like Grant said, the SCA stands for the Student Conservation Association. It's a nationwide group, and it basically places interns or fellows in different locations around the world, around the country, that focus on conservation issues. And it's also part of the AmeriCorps program. It has a lot of different activities that fellows and interns do. I think I'm one of the a little bit different because I'm not stationed outdoors, but I get to work on a lot of similar issues and values that the SCA embodies. And I started off with I'm placed with the city of Pittsburgh with the Sustainability and Resilience Division. And I started off as a college intern, I think in the August of 2019. And then I was there for my last year as a senior at Chatham University. And then when I graduated, I think we all wanted me to stay around a little longer and continue the work I was doing. So this opportunity to continue that work through the SCA, I took the opportunity. So I've been continuing the work I've done there and also explored a little bit of other things with the SCA program. So it's been a good way to stick around to see a project go a little bit longer and also meet other and expand my network and become aware of other programs that are out there.
How has that worked? The networking component is a real important part of the SCA program. How has that worked in the time of the pandemic? Do you guys continue to engage with one another in the different placements throughout the Pittsburgh region?
It's been a little difficult. I think we tried to do it a little bit more towards the beginning of the fellowship when I think we were all a little confused of what was going to happen, especially since some people were going to be outdoors or in person. So we did have like a few intro meetings at the beginning so I could meet the other Pittsburgh fellows. And don't think I mentioned this too, but at some point the SCA sent a reporter to interview me to talk about my experience as an SCA fellow in Pittsburgh. I don't know if that ever got published, but maybe there's an article out there. I think it was for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
So
I'm not sure. But yeah, I wish it would been better but to be in person and, you know, get to meet the other fellows. But at least they have a whole blog online. So you can, I guess, even after the fellowship, you can still stay connected or see what other people are doing.
That's exciting. And it's been, what has the experience taught you thus far, I guess, in terms of coming directly out of college and then into the fellowship experience? Like, what are some of the skills and kind of knowledge that you've been able to gain?
Yeah, so I think what I liked about the going into the fellowship is that I still get to explore a few things. Like I'm continuing doing what I was kind of doing as an intern, but also because the fellowship had, I guess, another vision, I've kind of been split. So I've also been exploring in other sides with within the resilience and sustainability world where I want to be, but exploring with, you know, zero waste things or composting. So it's like I get to explore that without, you know, being, I guess, in an official role yet. So I can kind of see what I like and still also apply some of those skills that before, you know, I only got to do in an academic setting. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that. I mean, I love school, but it's kind of like the amount of reports and work that you do, but it's never going to get, you know, practically used. And it's mm-hmm. nice to see that those things that I was learning before that I did enjoy, but now I can do it with solving real life problems and knowing that I'm like helping the division, the city, you know, meet those goals.
You know, that, and that's important. Maybe to transition a little bit to your project and talk about real world problems. You know, the issues of climate change are real and upon us. You know, it was just back in 2016, 2017, and then finally we passed the Pittsburgh Climate Action Plan in 2018, which is what's called a mitigation strategy. So how do you reduce CO2 and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? But in that time, we've experienced a lot of the acute impacts, both stressors and shocks that are associated with the need for climate adaptation, or effectively, how do we adjust our operations and ourselves really in the face of climate change? Maybe if I just pivot to Rebecca a little bit, would you be able to start and kind of introduce kind of what the, you know, the project that you helped shape for Melanie, and maybe we can get into some of the details with regards to kind of the connection that you've had with resilience planning and now kind of this idea of climate adaptation or climate preparedness.
Yeah, so back in 2019, when we found Melanie, we were kind of looking at, you know, the big question of, you know, we have this mitigation plan, we've done the resilience work, but the resilience work is a little bit broader than just climate. So that's, you know, social and physical shocks and stresses. But to dig a little bit deeper into the climate aspect of resilience, we were really interested in like, what are the impacts that we're currently experiencing? So, you know, we've been mitigating carbon or trying to mitigate carbon and setting targets for a long time. But, you know, are we actually already experiencing the effects of climate change? And so that was really the main question that Melanie started out with. So I don't know if, Melanie, you want to talk a little bit about some of the findings that you've come across. She's put together a really great slide deck, which I think we're going to try to superimpose here. But basically what Melanie's been looking at is, you know, historically, you know, how our temperature has been, how our climate has been in Pittsburgh. And then, you know, within the past few years or the past decade, are we experiencing any changes? So I'll turn it over to Melanie.
Yeah. So like Rebecca said, I basically was trying to put numbers, because I think anecdotally, the city kind of already had a sense that these things were occurring and that climate change was real, but we didn't really know concretely what exactly was changing or how much. So those are really the initial questions, because in order to plan for anything, we kind of need to know or baseline something to measure or to understand where these climate risks are occurring more frequently. So basically I just went through, also because I'm not a Pittsburgh native, so kind of familiarizing myself with the climate and everything. But I basically found four main areas of in climate that I think Pittsburgh, they're like its top concern. So that would be temperature changes, precipitation changes, air quality, and ecological health. And within those, there's a bunch of other stressors that go within, like landslides and flooding. So they're all interrelated, but these are like the four main concerns or areas where Pittsburgh has already seen climate risks. And, you know, starting off with temperature, like that's been an interesting one, because maybe in 2019 it wasn't such a concern, or since I was there since 2018, but in 2020, we've had like one of the warmest summers that Pittsburgh has experienced in a while. And that's kind of showing that well, I think what one of my findings was is that, yes, temperature is on average going to be increasing like the summer, but it's also going to have these fluctuations. So we're going to have higher highs and lower lows and these extreme swings. So we might have an extremely warm summer like we had this year in 2020. But they're also talking about having a really cold winter or early winter this year. So these are kind of the things of like this, the city has to be prepared for these both both extremes, and also what is that doing to like the infrastructure of, you know, the freezing, thawing, that in the summer you have higher costs from the electricity usage, the city, also the residents. So how do you prepare for that? And it's kind of, so that's kind of what I've been doing for each stressor. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of outlining, giving those numbers of like in the summer, understanding that these are kind of going to be the new normals, like we've been seeing since the last, I think if you go back the last 10 years, even the last 20 years, you're kind of seeing these events occurring more frequently with, I think like even in back in 2010, like once I'm going back, like I think there was one snow event where there was like 21 inches of snow in a single day. Yeah. I think it's referred as a snow
Snowmageddon.
Yeah, so like those kind of events, and I think in 2018 or 2019 we had that polar vortex event where it was like colder than some days in the Arctic. So it's kind of like one, acknowledging, I think the county, at the county level, it's been already acknowledged that climate change is one of the major drivers behind all of these events. I think in 2019 the auditor Deepak Pasquale. Yeah, he put out a report called The Cost of Climate Change on Taxpayers. And I think he found that in 2018, climate change accounted for like $260 million that taxpayers had to pay, indirectly from these climate costs. So it might have been from increased electricity costs or from, you know, having to invest more in slope remediation or road repair. So it's a real concern when we start quantifying these costs and putting numbers to it. I think it's easier to understand why it's such an important topic to be planning for proactively.
It really becomes kind of an impact on municipal operations, right? So when we're thinking about whether it's heating and cooling buildings or road repair and bridge repair, these are kind of impacts that are impacting the fiscal operations of the city, as well as the services that we deliver. Maybe if we can break each of those down, you talked a little bit about kind of temperature. What have you seen with precipitation?
So similar to temperature, it's kind of that fluctuation between really dry and really wet periods. But I think the concern is that because there is that big gap between dry and wet, those wet periods, it's the same amount of precipitation plus a little more. I think in Pennsylvania in general, precipitation, the average has increased about 10%. Of increase in precipitation, and it's expected to increase another 8% by 2050. So we have all that increased precipitation, but that's not falling equally distributed along the year or in the season. It's falling like in very concentrated events. And some of those terms is being keyed like microbursts. So these events that kind of just book intense rainfall in one area that kind of just pop up out of nowhere, and that's causing flooding, extreme flooding in certain neighborhoods, especially because of just the natural topography of Pittsburgh with a lot of hills. And going with that, also it's causing a lot of landslides from, again, we had really dry periods. So we have soil that's a little bit more prone to landslides, and also going to hold whether the soil is managed at all or the vegetation. So all these factors are accumulating into these smaller, more frequent, intense events. So that's kind of what we've been seeing with precipitation. And also, I think 2018 broke the record for the wettest year. Mm-hmm. And I think 2019 was like the second or third wettest year too. So we're already seeing that pattern of increasing. 2020 might be a little bit of an anomaly, but I guess we'll wait for the winter to see how much precipitation we get there. So it's, again, one of those other factors that it's not just precipitation, but it's like all the other things it's causing.
I remember in the slide deck that you're developing that you have a couple of pretty interesting slides that you've produced around kind of landslides. For both kind of you and Rebecca, I mean, that has an impact. Like, there's some specific geographies that are being impacted. I don't know, Rebecca, you've seen this in greenways. I mean, what is that? Maybe you could share a little, some insights that you have on that.
Yeah, I mean, just for some background information, like, our greenways network was originally created in the 1980s as a way to put a permanent conservation easement on steep hillsides, particularly where we had lost population after the decline of the steel industry. The houses were laying vacant. By nature, all of our greenways are basically in these steep slope areas where we should not be building. Since the 1980s, we have 12 greenways designated throughout the city in different neighborhoods. The city does not have the resources to maintain these properties. So they've largely been stewarded by unfunded volunteer community groups, which means that, we have invasive vine issues. The greenways are not in the best of health. They're not necessarily cared for. There's no resources, dedicated resources that go into them. So when we do have these rain events, if we do have those issues of invasive vines that are then choking out the tree canopy, and then, breaking up those root systems, that big wash of water then comes through and it topples down the hillside. So because we are not necessarily caring for those spaces, and they are sensitive areas, we're seeing more slides from those locations. And one of the biggest problems is, that is city property. It's public land. And so we're cleaning up from our own properties now. Planning and figuring out where those slides are going to occur and understanding how we should be planting those hillsides and caring for those hillsides is a big part of how we might be able to get ahead of, those landslide issues based on some of the work that Melanie's putting together.
So is there like preventative things that we could do, or kind of not preventative maintenance, or, prediction that do we know where, like, the next landslide? I mean, I know that that's kind of a loaded question in many regards, but because of like some of these pre-existing conditions that we're seeing in the environment, is there a way for us to get ahead of these incidences, and what can we do to be better prepared? Knowing that, Melanie's predictions about precipitation have been pretty spot on. So maybe after the SEA, maybe meteorology might be something you could look into. What are some things that we could be thinking about to get out in front of the issue?
I mean, better management of those hillsides. So, like I mentioned, there are certain species that you can plant. Trees have really good root systems. But a lot of our invasive vine problem, and it's a little bit of a tricky situation, because if you're pulling out, those invasives, that knotweed that's growing on the hillsides, you're still destabilizing until you replant it with something. So it takes a little bit of environmental engineering or ecosystem engineering to figure out what it is that's going to work well there. But I think that's, something that we should be exploring. Another issue that's come up multiple times is this deer problem that we have.
The continual theme on the Grant Street experience.
We have this overpopulation of deer that is eating the undergrowth. You can't have those bushes and those other, that undergrowth that grows underneath the trees to become established, which then, holds the hillsides together. So when you do have that problem, the deer browse, and then there's another issue with, deer poop, which is then being eaten by these worms, which is then further loosening the soil, particularly in Riverview Park. We now have, I just heard an estimate of like $46 million worth of landslide management in just in Riverview Park.
Not to interrupt, but I think we need a kind of the cycle, a graph in your slide deck, Melanie, that is effectively the deer cycle, we'll call it, and how they are doing this sort of damage. You know, it was funny too, just talking about the deer population. I was on a walk in the neighborhood going up Hampton towards Negley the other night, and there was three deer like right in the middle of the street, and they didn't even want to move. They were like, you know, hey, what's up, man? How you doing? Like, just continue to do their business. They weren't afraid or anything. It was like, you know, I was interrupting them. Like, so this whole shift in the city nature kind of paradigm is underway.
They're taking over.
They're like, taking put a over. Mask on. Yeah, exactly. They're like,
where's your mask?
Melody, another piece that you talk about in your work is in the slides that you prepared is the issue of air quality and kind of the connection between temperature and air quality. Can you share a little bit with listeners about what that looks like?
Yeah, so air quality is an interesting topic because I think historically Pittsburgh has been known for its really poor air quality because of its heavy industrial past. But it's been significantly improved since then. So I think most of the days are in that, you know, moderate air quality value. But now what we're seeing was, so because of these changes and these fluctuations in temperature and also these warmer summers that we're seeing, we're starting to see what these super pollution events, which are called inversions. So inversions occur when warm air is, is trapping cold air below. So you have that air pollution kind of stuck lower to the ground closer. Mm-hmm. So you're breathing in that pollution. And what has been occurring more frequently is that even if we have all the, you know, the factories, everything is in compliance, these air quality events are occurring more frequently. And I think the latest number that I could find was that in 2017, around 56% of the entire year was under an inversion event, whether that was like a small or a large inversion event. So that's a little concerning with it's not just the air quality, but if it's also really hot, that's also leading to a bunch of other health complications for, mm-hmm. for residents as well. I think the region also has like, it's their eighth worst county for air, I think asthma rates. So that compiles with, these air pollution events. Another factor that's also impacted by temperature is also pollen out there. So like all these other, it's just making it more difficult than the situation already is. And it's going to continue happening, I think, unless we either change the amount of, I guess, air pollution that's out there so we can control, so we don't have that much of that local pollution being generated during those events. And it's kind of, it doesn't really have a pattern. I think the majority of them would happen in the summer or towards the winter, but they kind of happen all year round.
Wow. So because of these temperature, the changes in you know, weather patterns, kind of the low pressure systems, you know, the increased warm days, you know, we're basically seeing more inversion events, more of these super pollution events occur. And you know, it's interesting to me because a lot of times there's a lot of attention that is, and deservedly so, pointed towards like industrial pollution. But this is also mobile, what we call mobile point source pollution as well. So it's transportation systems, you know, and kind of the quote unquote normal activities. I mean, Rebecca, what have you seen too with this in terms of what are some of the things that can be done to address this challenge in terms of the air pollution?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about, you know, the pandemic and how all of our lives have changed because of the pandemic now, you know, it's easier to work from home. We've been working from home since March. So when, you know, when you can kind of predict that there's going to be an inversion event, which is, you know, if the temperature has cooled down overnight and then you know that it's suddenly going to get real hot when the sun comes up, and that hot air is going to trap that colder air, like Melanie explained, you sort of know when it's going to happen, and it's typically in the morning. So I think one of the opportunities, you know, especially right now when we know how these systems are working and people are staying home, could we have some sort of, you know, a demand response? When you know an inversion event's going to happen, could we, you know, change the way that we do things if we can predict it? And, you know, maybe tell our workers to stay home for the day. We're having an air quality event. You know, maybe work from home or have a late start, or we could, you know, send our refuse trucks out later. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunity for like adaptive management, which is what we want to get to with a lot of the questions that Melanie's answering. You know, how do we start to predict, and then how do we actually adapt our operations to be able to handle that? But other things like, you know, planting more trees and paying more attention to our greenways and having those healthy ecosystems that are, you know, trapping some of those pollutants within the leaves. Like, those are all also strategies that are interrelated and could, you know, help act as that first line of defense against the changing climate, whatever the symptoms are.
The fourth thing that, you know, that kind of is a good segue. Like, the fourth thing that you identified, Melanie, is this idea of kind of ecological health. You know, so what have you seen there in terms of, you know, the visual impacts that you've been able to identify?
Yeah. So again, with the ecological health, I think most of it is following in that the greenways and the tree canopy, which is again related to all those issues of landslides and whether it could absorb some of those flooding impacts. But a lot of other things that are also being changed, and I think Rebecca's mentioned it several times, is just like the, I guess alluding to the health of the already existing greenway or tree canopy that we have, in terms of like climate change might bring more invasive species. I think also talking about like just the climate in general, I think Pittsburgh, like every city is going to change its climate. So like temperatures are going to be like the averages, the whole climate, the humidity, everything's going to change. So it's going to be like I forgot what city that they compare Pittsburgh is going to be more like, I think a little bit southern, more, a little bit more.
Alabama, I think we're off.
Yeah. So. So it's just like also maybe some of the native species might be changing, or it might be more attractive weather for more of these invasive species, which are not local to the region, and just going to be promoting more of that, that hill destabilization, and that decrease in the health of the tree canopy. So I think that whole system also affects a bunch of the social and the health issues, again, with the air quality, or even I think now during the whole pandemic, when a lot of us have been working from home indoors all the time, and you need that space to go outside. So just having access to those green areas, I think, has been more important. I think more people have been valuing that, that access to be able to go outside and have something green to look at after being indoors all the time, or not having that space with whole social distancing, like being able to have those parks and those greenways is also, I think, a measure of that social health aspect of it. So that ecological health is not just alluding to the natural systems, but it's also affecting, I guess, the social systems and economically as well. Like if we invest more on better pest management or landscaping, we have decreased costs and we don't have to be spending, you know, $8 million every year on just slope remediation, or $40 million, whatever that number is. So it's got a lot to do again with those social and economic factors, and often I think overlooked too as not important, or at least not the first thing that you come to think about.
Well, yeah, it's interesting though. I mean, because we've also seen, you know, we've done some of the overlays with environmental justice areas, right? You know, so maybe if you could share a little bit about what that looks like in terms of the connections in environmental justice, but also, I mean, you mentioned asthma. I mean, we're also seeing kind of these impacts on human health. So as the ecology of the city is changing and the ecological health is changing, it's also impacting human health, right? And so what are some of those things that have kind of been able to come up on the map?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the environmental justice areas, it really encompasses a lot of parts of Pittsburgh. So maybe that's a good thing to say, like, we just need to focus on an overall strategy to improve, you know, the ecosystem across, like, citywide. And I think it's also interesting because when you look at, like, measures, I think one of the measures of the map is there are, like, from each resident's home, like, what's the distance to, like, a green space or a park? And I think Pittsburgh ranks really highly in that because there's a lot of green spaces and parks, whether they're properly managed or if they're actually parks, that's a different story. But that, I think, tells that there's that opportunity to turn those lots or green spaces into something usable by residents. So there is that opportunity, there's that space and that opportunity to turn those. But also when you start overlaying like surface temperature, like a layer for surface temperature above a layer for tree canopy, you also start, or an income, like once you start having these layers, you kind of see that story of, yes, it turns to be those lower income neighborhoods that tend to have more of that gray space and higher surface temperatures. So I think one of the other things I've also found that, and in those more urban, more where you have more gray spaces, I think the temperatures can be up to 16 degrees hotter than, you know, surrounding temperatures of where you have more green space. So that difference really, that really does make a difference. How much trees you have around you, how much cement you have around you, or those reflective surfaces. So it could mean the difference, maybe not right now, but in the near future, that difference between having a summer that's like 100 degrees plus, which is not normal, or just having that low stick around in the 90s or 80s. So those kind of connections, when you start layering those together, you really start to see those stories.
So in many cases, you know, Rebecca, these greenways become places of healing from not just an ecological standpoint, but also from a human health standpoint. You know, we're in the process of developing a project with the neighborhood of Hazelwood and the Hazelwood Greenway. I mean, it connects to this, what Melanie was just saying about the proximity and the partnership with the Trust for Public Land and the 10-minute walk score. How does a project like that play into kind of the issues that Melanie's raising in terms of remediating some of these challenges?
Yeah, I mean, so we have this Greenways Stewardship Program, which has kind of waxed and waned since the 80s, depending on, you know, neighborhood involvement. I think that, you know, if we can start to, and we have a Greenways 2.0 planning process that we went through a few years ago, which called to strengthen that program. I don't know. I like to think of the greenways as like Pittsburgh's Amazon. Like, this could, I just feel like there's a lot of opportunity.
Rainforest, that is, right? Yeah. Amazon, like, rainforest, right?
Yeah, Amazon rainforest. But, you know, we have 1,200 acres across the city. That's a significant amount of land. And there's a lot of opportunity there. So I think, you know, as we start to infuse some funding into these spaces, let them be community driven. Try to build up the capacity of these greenway stewardship groups and allow them to you know, really vision how they want to use these locations. Mm-hmm. We can think about the greenways as like, and the parks and all of our green space as, you know, a first line of defense against the changing climate. You know, you have that tree canopy coverage, you have the root systems, they sequester water, they sequester carbon. I just think that there's a lot of opportunity, particularly in those spaces which are unmanaged right now, to act as a buffer against whatever it is that we're going to face, since it fluctuates so much, as Melanie's uncovered.
Maybe just to wrap up, we've kind of tapped a little bit around this. The fiscal impacts, you know, whether it's investing here, not investing here, predictive analytics, you know, one of the things that, you know, we've seen in kind of the research in recent years is the lack of a risk management strategy. So you see this a lot in coastal areas, where the challenges of insurance and insurance finance, are effectively starting to assign risk to real estate and to property and casualty issues because they're seeing challenges like hurricanes and sea level rise. In inland cities like us, it's a little bit different because these are slower moving challenges. But you guys have started to been able to document, you know, kind of what the fiscal impacts are. I don't know if you want to be able to kind of share that. Either it's what we've seen with kind of landslides or you know, on the other side, what some of the basics of preventive maintenance could do and what we need to do to shine a light on those sorts of opportunities.
I mean, I can start
off with, start with Rebecca. Yeah.
With a little bit of what we can glance by just looking at the capital and operating budget, it's a little bit difficult to kind of right now, I guess, assign those costs and say this is attributed to climate change, since some of those costs aren't, you know, truly apparent. So we can't like incorporate how much was spent in that additional time of having people going out there to clean up after landslides. Or how many vehicles were sent and things like that. So it's hard to account. But just if you look at how much was spent specifically for landslide or slope remediation, you can clearly see in like the last 5 years that significant increase. So I think in 2017, it wasn't even $1 million that the city was spending. Less than 1% of the budget was going towards slope remediation. And then 2018, that 1 year where that broke the record for the wettest year on record. You can see that the city, I think the city really was under budget for slope remediation. And I think they had to take an additional $6.8 billion just allocated. Like out of where did that money come from? I'm not sure, but they had to divert that from somewhere else for that slope remediation. So I think in, again, 2018, it was 1% of the entire operating budget that was going towards slope remediation flooding issues. And then in 2019, it jumps up all the way to 5% of the entire budget. Now that's pretty significant. Now from 1% to 5%, that's kind of like a 5 times more of that money being spent. And when you look at, I guess, preventative measures, I think the number that people throw around is every $1 that would have been spent on mitigation could save $6 of cleanup costs. So those, that 1 to 6, that's I guess 6 times of money you could save in the future if you would proactively plan for these things. So that could be, you know, saving that jump from 5%. So we don't want to be seeing these increases in unexpected costs, especially now with, you know, everyone's talking about the budget, but if we could just proactively plan, I think it would save more. And making people realize just how much has been impacted, I think, is one of those big important things that I'm hoping the work I've been doing in this plan does, is just show, like, make people understand that so they can see why it's a good decision to prioritize and kind of invest proactively when you know the numbers now.
A famous Pennsylvanian said an ounce of prevention is equals a pound of cure. He was from the other side of the state, but I think it really rings true in this instance that in understanding and the work that you're doing is so important, Melanie, in terms of understanding what these risks and threats are. But more importantly, you know, Rebecca, maybe just to finish up here, it's the education, right? Like this is something that's relatively new in terms of our understanding of this. What are some things in terms of helping to get this message out and to kind of share? Because we have to build the capacity in order to, you know, effectively address this challenge. And what are some of your thoughts with that?
Yeah, I mean, some of the first things that we've been doing is, you know, taking Melanie's show on the road. So, you know, we've been talking to some of our partners and people who work in the space, you know, external to the city government, just for extra input, anything else that they might be seeing, you know, research. We talked to the Rand Corporation, you know, other water experts. But now I think we're at a point where, you know, we've refined some of this and gotten a lot of input from, you know, vast corners of how the climate's changing. And I think, you know, now what we're starting to do is kind of talk to our colleagues about it. other to bring it to other departments, understand how their operations might be impacted or affected, or how their budget might be affected. I think that that's, you know, there's two areas to go. It's how do we impact the budget and our other departments to change their operations? And then how also do we gain the support from the public and from our residents who are experiencing these things, but maybe aren't calling them climate change? You know, we all have basement backups. We're all seeing flooding. I have a landslide happening in my backyard. Like, we all see this stuff, but we're not necessarily attributing it to the changing climate. So how do we get our residents to support the investment that needs to be made and the changes that need to happen within the city government?
Yeah, it really starts to become a critical dot connecting exercise. You know, just to be clear, I mean, the dollars that are spent in remediating and cleaning up landslides are dollars that need to be spent because they're effectively, you know, impeding public safety or, you know, negatively impacting people's lives. So the question becomes like, how, you know, exactly that, like building that kind of education and awareness and then being good stewards of the resources that we have, right? Mm-hmm. So, well, hey, with that, I want to thank you both. Rebecca, as always, great job in finding this terrific SCA fellow. She is a diamond in the rough and has been a great asset for our team. Melanie, we thank you so much, and some difficult work ahead, but you have definitely laid the foundations for us, and we appreciate kind of the efforts that you're putting forth on behalf of the city of Pittsburgh. So good work, and kudos to you. So with that, I want to thank our guests, and thank you all for listening in to another episode of the Grant Street Experience. More to come. As we sign off, I just want to thank our cable team, Bill and Alex, for their great job in collecting this information and in the editing and the work that they do. And thank you all for listening to the Grant Street Experience. And until next time, we'll see you soon. Take care. Thank you.